Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. This is day 31 of the government shutdown. Federal employees are going without paychecks, and at midnight tonight, SNAP benefits will end for over a million in North Carolina in a move that State Attorney General Jeff Jackson calls willful.
The truth is, they have the money.
Meanwhile, Charlotte area air traffic controllers raise concerns about the impact of the shutdown on their workforce. The trial of those accused in the 2019 murder of Scott Brooks begins, and though jury selection was expected to be challenging, Brooks' twin brother appreciates the public's support.
Oh, it just warms my heart about the support that we have throughout the city of Charlotte.
CMS sets policy on the use of artificial intelligence. We learn more about last Thursday's crime spree involving an abduction and a shootout at a major intersection, and it's do or die for Charlotte FC in Game 2 of the MLS playoffs. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News Senior Editor Eli Portillo. He's here along with Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. David Hodges is an investigative reporter at WBTV, and our returning champion from last week is Hunter Sines. He's here for the second week in a row, much against his better judgment. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. So the federal government shutdown is 4 days away from being a record breaker. Meanwhile, recipients of SNAP benefits nationwide are bracing for a loss of benefits beginning at midnight tonight. That includes 1.4 million North Carolinians, 143,000 Mecklenburg County residents, and 600,000 children statewide. Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill are pointing fingers at each other, but this week marked the first week that federal government employees did not receive their paychecks, and now millions are set to go hungry. North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson released a video this week explaining what is about to happen, and he made this point.
Whatever your politics, we should think about how this will feel when it goes from social media debate to reality. Watching it sweep across the country, the lines at food pantries, at churches, the desperation, how this will hit our schools, teachers, being asked to handle classrooms with a lot more hungry kids. And just as we're all sitting down to celebrate Thanksgiving, this is becoming a national crisis.
So Mary, is this the moment where the rubber meets the road, where things change, that force politicians to talk to each other?
I think it is. We have the holidays coming up, and you do have, you know, most of the folks that are getting these food benefits are working adults. They just need this to help their families. And many of the folks also affected are, as you mentioned, children, the disabled, folks like this. And so also polling is coming out, and the American people are getting pretty frustrated. The head of the largest union for federal workers has said that both Democrats and Republicans need to get together to try to come up with some kind of compromise. And as I said, polling now is showing that most folks are blaming A majority of folks are blaming Trump and the Republicans for this. And so that's why you see President Trump, who is very aware of polling and people knowing that he's building a ballroom and he was on an Asia trip while this was going on, he is putting his attention to it. And is even saying that Republicans should force the filibuster, break the filibuster, and pass this clean resolution. But as you said, yes, it is a people a problem right now, and people know that politicians are getting paid, and they really need to not just depend on food banks.
They're getting paid, and at least on the Republican side of the House, they're not working because they're not in session and haven't been for a month. More than 80% of SNAP recipients are working adults. Others are children. Still others, as you pointed out, are retirees or those with handicaps. Martha Goodlett of Gastonia was in line on Wednesday at Community Relief Organization of Mount Holly, and she told WSOC-TV that she will go hungry if she loses the $179 a month that she gets in SNAP benefits.
Listen to me. In Washington, D.C., do not take away from us, please.
If those benefits go away and don't come back soon, what options do these people have for food, Eli?
Well, a lot of local governments are asking people to step up and donate to food banks. In South Carolina, where 550,000 people receive SNAP benefits, the governor there has activated what's called the 1SC Fund, which is kind of a central clearinghouse for disaster relief donations. Gastonia, in Gaston County, the government there is asking people to donate infant formula and other food essentials to food banks. Nourish Up in Mecklenburg County, which operates the Meals on Wheels program, is again soliciting donations. There are also farmers markets that are giving out $50 credits to people with EBT cards. But I think it's important to note that these kind of private step up, everyone pull together efforts can't fill the whole gap. For example, Nourish Up, which again runs the Meals on Wheels and senior nutrition programs, they have an annual budget in Charlotte of around $7 million. Mecklenburg SNAP recipients in the county get about $20 million every single month. So you have, you know, around like $240 million versus $7 million. People are not going to be able to donate $200 million in private donations on short notice to fill in that annual gap. So the longer this goes on, the impacts will start being felt acutely and pretty quickly.
David?
And when you speak about children, it also is, you need to note that programs like Head Start, a lot of the programs have to stop. And in those programs, children don't just receive child care. And parents will have to decide whether they're going to take care of their kids to go to work, but they receive learning and also two or more nutritious meals. So we're talking about not just the SNAP benefits being cut affecting children, but also cutting these other programs that in many cases will have to shut down.
Yeah, I was a little confused. We talked about this before the program started this morning, that this may or may not impact the SNAP cuts, may or may not impact children going to schools at CMS. Over 40,000 CMS students currently receive free school meals through the community eligibility provision, which is tied to SNAP. And yesterday I read an article that said it's going to put them in jeopardy. And this morning there was an article that said kind of the opposite. Mary, clear me up on this if you can.
Well, it's very confusing. I don't particularly understand all of it. Maybe other panelists will help. But it is true that for some of these programs, in order to be involved and get the benefit of them, you have to fill out application and forms. If you go to a school that's not covered under community eligibility provision. Also, if you're eligible for SNAP, you're automatically eligible for school lunches. But with the budget reconciliation bill that Donald Trump signed into law this year, that will tighten guidelines for who qualifies for SNAP benefits. And that could affect which schools are able to give free lunches to all students in the upcoming year. So I don't think any school they will use everything they can to make sure kids get fed, but they might be limited.
According to what I read yesterday, if SNAP is suspended, only two schools in the CMS system will still qualify for these community eligibility provisions, forcing tens of thousands of students to individually apply for meal assistance. And evidently that's being asked of these people. They're being advised to apply for these right now, but that I would think would take time. In his video explaining what was going on to people in North Carolina, Attorney General Jeff Jackson talked about a letter that all 50 states received from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which runs the SNAP program, telling the states not to provide food assistance to anyone beginning tomorrow. He says their claim that they must stop SNAP benefits due to the shutdown and the lack of funds is not true.
The truth is, they have the money. They have a $6 billion emergency fund that Congress gave them for exactly this situation.
And to him, the reasoning behind this is clear.
They are choosing not to use that fund. And I believe the reason they're doing that is to ratchet up the pain for the shutdown. This is a political move, and that's illegal.
He went on to explain why this move is illegal, and it appears to follow a familiar pattern in the Trump administration.
When Congress gives a department money to fund a program, the department can't just refuse to fund it. That would be the same as the department overriding Congress, and they don't get to do that. So today, I and a number of AGs are taking the department to court.
The Trump administration, and the New York Times has an editorial about this morning, is on the road to autocracy. And this is one of the things that autocracies do. They ignore the Congress. They ignore the courts. North Carolina Democratic Representatives Alma Adams, Deborah Ross, Valerie Fouché, and Don Davis are calling for the USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins to fund SNAP benefits despite the shutdown. Initially, the Department of Agriculture said it would dip into that fund to provide benefits and then reversed itself. Is that decision, along with the legality of not using congressionally appropriated funds, going to give these attorneys general around the country a leg up in court? Does anybody know?
Well, it may, depending upon the judges they get. We've seen the federal judiciary, but that's one reason why the Democrats are holding out and saying they want some guarantees of monies before they end the shutdown and then go into negotiations, because there's no trust that any promises that are made will be kept when it comes to funding, because already we've seen the Trump administration come in and basically say, all of these monies that you have passed and you've approved, I'm just not going to spend them. And we've seen so little pushback from congressional Republicans who have been very eager to pretty much say, okay, I'm going to give away my power and give away my power in the Constitution.
Eli.
Yeah, I think based on the news coverage of the lawsuit from the states, it sounds like the judge that they've got is skeptical that, you know, the Trump administration is saying they can't spend the money. Yesterday afternoon, the judge sounded sympathetic to the state's argument that they should spend this emergency money. But to echo your and Mary's point, it's a big, giant administrative task. I mean, you're talking about shifting billions of dollars from accounts to distributing them to 50 states, et cetera, while the government is shut down. So I'm not clear that even if the judge were to order, hey, spend this money, how quickly can it happen? And especially how quickly can it happen if the administration doesn't want it to happen quickly? I mean, it's a lot of work to do when the government is shut down. And I think you could easily see them just say, oh, yeah, we'll get to that.
David?
And to Eli's point, if that does take time, what so many families are doing right now who rely on these benefits is saving what they do have left for when the funds run out. And as Eli mentioned, these food banks just cannot keep up with the amount of supply. Jeff Jackson also mentioned ratcheting up the political pressure and the pain of the shutdown. It'll be really interesting to see what some of the pushback is politically on this, because a lot of the communities that need these resources the most aren't inner city, aren't Mecklenburg County, it's rural. And Gaston County, it's about 15% of people currently receiving SNAP benefits, about 36,000 people. So this is going to be felt across the entire state, not just small metropolitan areas.
Only have about a minute left, but Mary, this harkens back to the request by many presidents in the past for the line item veto on the budget, which I think finally passed during the Clinton administration, giving the president an opportunity to cross things out that he didn't like in the budget. But there is no budget, and this is not the line item veto. This is just unilaterally taking action, isn't it? Or is this the same thing?
Well, no, it is kind of him saying, I just don't want to fund this. But as David pointed out, this is not Republican or Democratic or red or blue state. And it seems at this point that they're holding people who are hungry people hostage in order to get a deal. And that is not looking good to the American people.
So when we come back, we'll take a look at some of the things that the other area states are doing in the interim before the government caves on this SNAP thing, which they may or may not do, I suppose, and look at other aspects of the impact of the government shutdown, particularly on air travel and what that's doing here. And then, of course, the Brooks trial, Scott Brooks trial, got underway this week. And we'll talk about that with somebody who was in the courtroom, Hunter Sines. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo is with us because it's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks. He's our senior editor here at WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast. Hunter Hines is with us along with his newfound puppy. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. And David Hodges is an investigative reporter for WBTV. Some nearby states are forging a path through this snap suspension, which begins tonight at midnight, in various different ways. Virginia will use state funding to keep SNAP running. That state's Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, is planning to allocate about $37.5 million per week to that state's program, which serves about 850,000 people. But Eli, our governor, Josh Stein, can't do that. Why?
My understanding is it's because of the way our budget process works and the reserve funds. I think it's also interesting to note, I was thinking about differences, and you know what's happening in Virginia right now, next week, there is a little election. So I think, you know, you've got the governor's election in an off year in Virginia, which I think gives them probably some incentive to say, especially on the Republican side, like Youngkin, hey, look, we're doing something here. You know, don't hold this against us, because they've got a pretty hotly contested governor's race for his successor there.
Yeah, he's not running again. Meanwhile, in South Carolina, Governor Henry McMaster is activating, as you alluded to a moment ago, Eli, that state's 1SC fund to help backfill some of the missing SNAP funds.
We're here to address the needs of the people of our state and their safety during this time of trial, when the food for a lot of people has been cut off by the dysfunction in Washington.
So he's essentially asking for donations, because that effort is privately funded. Here in Charlotte, the nonprofit, as was mentioned, Nourish Up, is gearing up to fill in where it can. They run the Meals on Wheels programs. They have that annual budget of $7.2 million a year, but they cannot make up for the loss of SNAP funds. Nourish Up's chief operating officer, Danielle Moore.
This is truly a all hands on deck, collaborative approach in making sure that, you know, we have some sort of strategic plan in place where we can make sure that we can keep our doors open for the long haul and fill, you know, everyone's kitchen table with whatever that they need.
So I know, because we reported on it this morning on WFAE and Morning Edition, that some area large organizations are kicking in money right now to help fill in the gaps. Is there any kind of effort going on for small dollar donations from average citizens? Any organized effort?
I think South Carolina's is the most formalized, because they have this 1SC fund, which is administered by a private foundation but collects donations to distribute statewide when there are disasters. For example, they were activated during Hurricane Helene to collect, centralize, and distribute donations. I'm not aware of any effort that centralized statewide in North Carolina, but there are a lot of informal efforts that I've seen. One from, you know, your organized groups, Nourish Up, Second Harvest, Metrolina. They are making emergency appeals. I've also noticed in my personal life and, you know, the CMS school that I'm connected with, parents and neighborhoods are posting, where can we donate? Can we clear our school's lunch debt for kids who, you know, don't have funds to pay? Can we bring donations of food or like a Harris Teeter gift card or something like that, so that teachers can discreetly distribute them to low-income students in classes? So I have personally seen those efforts starting to be organized at the neighborhood school and even individual family level, which, if there is any silver lining, it is wonderful to see people coming together in that way.
I also understand there's like restaurants that are giving free meals to federal workers, to people who are hungry. I go to the Y, they have boxes. But I want to note that for many, many years post-New Deal, that Republicans have often railed against programs like Social Security and Medicare that Americans have become really dependent on, like try to take away faux Social Security now, because they've often said this is a form of welfare, and that actually churches and schools and individual charities and personal charity should step in. And I think we're seeing with this that that won't work. That long time goal of, and you look at Project 2025, and they talk about eliminating and reducing things like Head Start and a lot of these programs. And I think people across the political spectrum are realizing that is not a solution to America's poor, to the disabled, to people who need to step up, to people who are working that just aren't making it, but are paying taxes and living their lives. And I think people should really think about that. Think about what the country would be like. We don't miss these programs, or we may rail against them as big government, but so many people depend on them.
Yeah. As a sidebar, because of the shutdown, North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services does not currently have funding to maintain benefits past early November for the more than 262,000 people who depend on the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women's, Infant, and Children. That's the WIC program. But this shutdown is not just about food assistance. It's impacting federal workers who did not receive a paycheck for the first time this week and will not receive a paycheck until the shutdown is resolved. And that includes air traffic controllers around the country and at Charlotte Douglas International Airport, where members of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association local handed out pamphlets to inform passengers about the effects of the shutdown. Eli, what did those pamphlets say?
Well, simply put, they said, we are still working and we are not getting paid because there are already big staffing concerns with air traffic controllers. They're short-staffed across the country. Many of those folks have to work mandatory overtime. This is a long-standing concern where they've been working in some cases 6-10-hour days is pretty routine for a lot of them. And now they're doing that without getting paid. We've started to see some impacts, like just yesterday, National Airport in Washington had a ground stop for a few hours because of there weren't enough staff in the tower. And we saw, I think, 7,000 delays total nationwide last weekend, largely due to staffing. They are going to keep working and keep doing their best. You know, air traffic controllers don't play around, but they're already stretched thin. They're working mandatory overtime without any pay right now.
Yeah.
That's a recipe for trouble heading into Thanksgiving.
National Air Traffic Controllers Association local President Anthony Schifano told WFAE that they would continue to focus on keeping the skies safe.
You know, one thing I can say is that we will come to work to do our job. And if delays are required, they're required to make sure that we can provide the safest airspace system that we can.
But like everyone, air traffic controllers have to eat, they have to pay rent, they have to make their car payment, and he quickly added that those controllers are searching for alternative sources of income.
We've received messages from some of our membership indicating that this is going to be an issue for them. Some of them have actually taken up the opportunities to do ride shares, deliver DoorDash, those type of things. That should not be something that an air traffic controller should even have to entertain when they have to go to work to provide a service to the flying public.
And as you mentioned, Eli, controllers have already been working mandatory overtime 6 days a week with shifts as long as 10 hours a day. How concerned should we be that air traffic controllers being worked like that are distracted by personal situations like having to pay the rent and find the money to do that while they're not being paid for their jobs and having to moonlight as an Uber driver? How should we look at that?
We all want an air traffic controller that's tired, frustrated, moonlighting, and worried. I took a flight last week, and I have to say it was a little more crowded. And we see also like Orlando's airport had to have some kind of a work stoppage, which all those trips to Disney World, you know, people aren't going on them because they're saving money. But everybody was doing their jobs. They were being very professional, they were in good spirits and they were good sports, but you did have to feel for them. I think the lines were a little longer. And even I've noticed that TSA PreCheck, which I have, that those lines are becoming pretty long as well. But you know, they're doing the best they can, but you do notice the crowds and you can tell that there is frustration because they are worried about their families as well. And I think we all have to also keep in mind the holidays are coming up and travel, people are already making their travel plans now. So we can just imagine the crush that they are going to be under.
So let's switch gears a little here. In December of 2019, Scott Brooks was opening Brooks Sandwich Shop in Noda in the morning when he was shot and killed. And after all these years, this happened in 2019, and after all these years, the trial of the two people accused of his murder, Stephen Staples and Terry Connor, that trial finally got underway. Hunter, what's taken so long for this case to go to trial?
Well, it's been a mix. We, of course, have had a court case backlog that I think we all have reported on. A big contributor to that was, of course, COVID, and then a lack of resources when it comes to funding adequate amount of judges and DAs to take on the amount of cases that we have. Usually, we are told that a case can go to trial once an incident happens. Specifically, let's take a homicide. It could take at least 5 years to get it to trial, and that's at least. And so we're 6 years past, but we are finally here for this case. Right now, Mike, what is happening is jury selection. It has been methodical. Both Stephen Staples and Terry Connor are actually being tried together in the same trial. So each the prosecutors, then each defense team has time to question the potential jurors. So this is taking a while, and it will likely go well into next week.
You were in the courtroom for the opening days of this trial, and the judge heard several motions from both the prosecution and the defense over that course of time. One motion from the defense was to ask for a delay for the start of this trial. The judge struck it down. After 6 years, why did they feel they needed to delay it even more?
Well, there were nearly 49,000 jail calls between these suspects throughout the past few years that had taken place.
So what does that mean?
Literal phone calls in the jail that were being taken between the suspects and other people. The defense team, of course, argued that they have not had the time to go through every single one of those phone calls. The prosecutors then rebutted, saying, we do not intend to use any of those phone calls as evidence. So that was one of the reasons. The other reason was the medical examiner had recently spoke with the state and gave a sort of opinion that the defense felt like they needed time to get their own expert to rebut if he were to go on the stand and basically say that he didn't believe, or he did not know whether the victim in this case, Scott Brooks, was crouched down when he was shot or was standing up because of the projected way that the bullet
injured him. Why would that matter? Why would that matter?
I guess it would matter because of their arguments of there is the known fact that Scott Brooks was trying to defend himself when these two suspects are seen on surveillance video robbing him and then shooting him. You do not see you don't see him get shot on the actual surveillance video. So there is a lot of what actually happened. Was he standing up? Was he crouched down? That could be the difference between a first-degree murder or another charge, arguably, if you're the defense attorney, correct? So I believe that is their thinking of why it could have mattered, but the judge said it didn't.
David, you wanted to chime in.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that Hunter just mentioned in talking about the defense attorneys asking for a delay and the overall picture, my colleague Naomi Coles recently interviewed DA Spencer Merriweather, and he didn't just bring up the fact that he's grateful for more prosecutors, but that there need to be more public defenders. I mean, one of the reasons these cases are taking so long to come to trial is because there just aren't enough defense attorneys to even take these cases. And I interviewed another attorney named Brad Smith, who used to be a prosecutor, now is a defense attorney. These cases don't get better with age. I mean, the longer they take, the more difficult they are to prosecute and to try. So you have an entire lack of resources in this network of criminal justice, and that makes it even more unlikely that there is justice for families like this in the end.
Brooks Sandwich Shop in Noda has been part of this community for generations. It was started by these twins' father. And on the opening day of the trial, Scott Brooks' twin brother, David, expressed his appreciation for the support the community has given him and his family over these last several years.
When I open a Bible, I see my brother. When I say my prayers, I see my brother. And when I open my business, I see my brother. And so many other people do, too, because he was such a people person.
And in fact, David, WBTV reported this week that the Charlotte community never stopped showing up for the Brooks family. Talk about that.
Once I mute myself a little, our reporter, Katie Soult, she's been out there. She's been covering this trial. frequently. And while jury selection is going on and taking so long and could continue to take longer, she has been out at the sandwich shop talking with the loyal customers who just want to keep supporting them. I mean, think about how long it has been since this murder and talking about it. And customers still think about that and they still show up to support in that sense. So this is something that's really impacted the community. And these types of individual stories of these awful crimes, I think, really highlight the bigger challenges that the city and criminal justice system face, because, you know, ultimately, these aren't just numbers and crime statistics. People are getting hurt and sometimes dying.
So they've spent the week going through motions and trying to seat a jury. And you say, Hunter, that security, because you've been in the courtroom all week, security for this trial was tight. You say it's the first time you had to walk through metal detectors, both going into the courthouse and going into the courtroom. Why is security so tight?
I think it's because of how high profile this case is. Many of the jurors who were questioned had said they had heard about it or seen stuff on the news. Also, you are arguably dealing with suspects who are alleged to have committed other very violent crimes. When we were asking if we could have our camera in court for this trial, even the prosecutors brought up that there are some witnesses who are fearful of being plastered over there because of the details of this case, because of the alleged suspects in this case. And so I believe it was just an extra security measure that Judge Lou Trosh wanted there just to be safe.
Okay. Last week, Hunter, you reported on a crime spree which included an abduction and the car chase with a shootout at a major intersection right down the street from WBTV, as a matter of fact. This week, we know a bit more about what happened and what led up to that. But first of all, recap for us in the 90 seconds that we have what the events of last week. What happened?
Yeah. So basically, this man, now that we know, went on this crime spree. He ordered a Lyft car ride. We know the Lyft driver was shot and killed. He then wrecked that vehicle and then shot another guy in his vehicle while he was on his way home from work, pulled him out, stole his car, wrecked it, then went into a nearby home at random, kidnapped a mother in front of her child at gunpoint, made her drive towards Florida. They got by Pinkies there on the near west side, and she saw an opportunity when she was boxed in to jump out of the car and went and got help. He was shooting at officers nearly this entire time, continued shooting at officers when he was running away down Moorhead. Officers shot and killed him.
She was lucky, but there were two innocent victims who were shot and killed in this exchange, and we want to talk about that and what she told the media about her experience and how she got through it safely, being abducted and in that car. We'll do that when we come back. Also, some news on an impending choice for CMPD chief to replace Johnny Jennings, and CMS looks at AI policy and makes recommendations on how teachers and students should use it going forward, plus the election. We'll get to it all.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, WFAE's senior editor, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. David Hodges is with us, an investigative reporter for WBTV, and Hunter Sines, a reporter for WSOC-TV. It must be Friday. Let's talk some more about this crime spree and what we've learned in the past week since it occurred over on the west side. The woman who was abducted at gunpoint by the suspect, Joseph Andrade, shared her experience with the media. What did she say happened?
Mike, this is like out of a very tragic and scary crime movie, honestly. She says that she had just gotten home with her 9-year-old son. She gets into the house. He's putting his bags down. Her husband is there with them. And all of a sudden, her son comes into the room where they are and says, somebody is in the house. Somebody has broken into the house. They come out and he's standing there and puts them all at gunpoint and says, she's coming with me. Joseph Andrade and forces all of them down at gunpoint, says the mom is coming with, puts her in the car, forces her to drive her car off. her husband is able to call police and give that crucial description who to police who are already in the area for the previous crimes that had happened. But she told us that Joseph Andrade had told her he was going to kill her because she had him on video, the Ring video, going in and out of the house. She also said that she was about to run out of gas, and he made the insinuation that, well, before I carjack my next person, I've got to get rid of you because, again, you have me on video. She tells us that the only thing that got her through was her faith. She could feel God's presence around her. And her watching many crime movies and TV shows over the years, that she knew when to take the opportunity when she got it to get out. Again, she felt boxed in at a red light with a car in front of her, police behind her. She jumps out and runs into Pinky's.
So what else do we know about this now deceased perpetrator?
So we know he is from Florida. We still have no real idea why he was in Charlotte in the first place. We clearly know, based on her account, that he was forcing her to drive down toward Florida to get back. But as far as any type of criminal past, which I will say, Mike, you and I know, we usually, when it's something this big, you know, these many victims, this violent of crimes, you usually have a past. There was no violent criminal past. There were, I believe, DUI stuff in Florida. There were some traffic violations in Florida, but nothing here out of Charlotte.
So meanwhile, there was a Lyft driver who was shot as the car chase with this perpetrator and CMPD took place. He has now died. You also report that his passenger also shot at the alleged perpetrator. Once Shabazz Grant, the Lyft driver, was hit. Grant was the father of four with another child on the way. He was the second victim to die as a result of this incident. The other was Justin Carlton. He, too, was an innocent victim who was shot on his way home from work. Did the shooting begin before or after the police were in pursuit?
So the shootings of those two victims happened before the pursuit happened. They were shot and killed. Police were responding to those on Hoskins Road when the kidnapping was happening literally a block behind Hoskins, unbeknownst to police until that victim's husband called saying, "My wife was just kidnapped in our own car by this random man." And then the pursuit happened. And he started shooting at police during that pursuit.
Meanwhile, it was announced yesterday that the city has chosen a replacement for outgoing CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. I'm not sure which one of you to ask about this, you, Hunter, or you, David. What do we know about this?
So multiple sources told Channel 9, various reporters of us there yesterday, that the city has made a decision in this and that the announcement could come any day. We initially were told that it could come by the end of this week with a formal introduction at some point next week. We have reported, based on sources telling us, the top contenders included a former CMPD deputy chief, Stella Patterson, who used to be the police chief in Raleigh until earlier this year when she retired from that role. In her exit interview, Mike, she actually said she was taking a pause, floating who knows what. But then the other top contender, we are told by sources, included Minneapolis chief Brian O'Hara. Now, since that report, Minneapolis Police Department has reached out saying that he never actually applied. Of course, arguably, we would never get the proof to that. It's not really a record we can get. So no telling, really. But that is where we stand right now. As the decision has been made, now we're just waiting for an announcement.
So as we recall, Johnny Jennings, the current CMPD chief, threatened to sue over a series of texts sent by former Charlotte City Council member Tariq Bakari, which allegedly threatened his job and his legacy. The city settled that case, including the retention bonus. But Jennings is leaving at the end of the year, so I'm not sure why they paid the retention bonus after 33 years on the force and also serving as chief since 2020. The Fraternal Order of Police in Charlotte has called for the National Guard to come to Charlotte to quell crime, and they've also called for an outside hire for Jennings' replacement. Is this because they've lost confidence in Jennings in particular or the current leadership team?
I think what I have gathered, and David may hear more from his own contacts as well, but from what I have gathered, it is a lack of belief in how the current system has gone over the past few years. And I'm not even talking about just the chief and deputy chiefs. I'm also talking about city management, the city of Charlotte leadership. And so I believe they just want this, let's start fresh with a new person with outside perspectives coming in who hasn't been raised by CMPD, who hasn't been in the trenches of it, to finally lead this department.
David, can you shed any more?
I think it has a lot more to do with the process in general. I would say the city manager, the city council, and to Hunter's point, what they see as an opportunity, probably, and not just this FOP, but any type of union or police association would want to see somebody come in from the outside who might be a little bit more flexible to not doing things the way that they have been done and more receptive to their own ideas. So you just pick an organization and you probably find a group of people saying the exact same thing.
Hunter.
Now, I will say very quickly, Mike, one of the contenders who we've reported on, Stella Patterson, who used to be for decades here with CMPD, I will say she was very well liked by even patrol officers, you know, top brass, whoever. She was very supported and very well liked. Her name has been talked about in this search process to me as we would welcome her with open arms. So if she is, I think there would be a lot of support, a lot of agreement that it's a tricky place because she's from outside, but she also used to be inside.
It's a perfect blend. And my sources are saying the same thing, Hunter. Yeah.
Okay. I think the Fraternal Order of Police might want to pull back on that call for the National Guard, because that would say that they are not doing their jobs correctly. And if you see the videos coming out from these other cities, do you really think that it would be a good thing to have for its citizens to have those scenes going on in Charlotte, North Carolina, with the new police chief coming in?
artificial intelligence is the new buzzword. It's the rage, right? It's the thing. All the kids are talking about it. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board unanimously passed a new policy dealing with how staff and students should use AI. Eli, what does the policy do?
Well, I think the most important things the policy does are, one, establishes a basic process for introducing AI, you know, so it's not just like a Wild West teachers doing it all on their own as they see fit. And two, it encourages the use of AI. So it doesn't say, hey, we've got to keep this out of the classroom. We don't want any of this. We need to go back to, you know, pen and paper and chalk on chalkboards. It says students should be encouraged to understand how AI works. And I'm reading from the policy now. Teachers should guide students in using AI tools for research, content creation, and learning. And students should use AI tools as a supplemental resource. But it also tries to create a balance where they say, we want them to use AI. We are encouraging this. We're not discouraging it. But we don't want AI to replace creative thinking. We don't want AI to be used for plagiarism. We don't want AI to be used to supplement students actually doing the work. And that's going to be the tricky balance to strike.
Yeah, they have to cite when they use AI. I'm not sure how you enforce that. But CMS board member Liz Monterey-Duvall praised this new policy.
AI is not going to take your job, but people that know AI and know how to use AI are going to take your job. And so I truly believe that, and I'm excited for this, and I think it's really cool that CMS is taking this step.
This comes following a survey that CMS conducted last spring that indicated the majority of respondents wanted to see more use of AI in the classroom. Who did they talk to? Who did they survey?
They threw it open to the community and really focused on parents. I received the survey as a CMS parent. AI, you know, I still think it might be a bubble. Hey, let's be honest. But I've never seen a technology go from weird novelty to business mainstay so fast. I mean, in like a year and a half. When I was a kid, they were having these same discussions about the internet. You know, I'm a 90s kid, born in the 80s, raised in the 90s. So when I was coming up, it was like, hey, should we let kids use the internet to do research, or do we need to force them to go to the library and check out books? Obviously, if you didn't learn how to use the internet, you're now at a big disadvantage in the jobs market. So I think we're seeing the same dynamic with AI.
You're so young. When I was a kid, they were having these conversations about the efficacy of the Encyclopedia Britannica. School board races are on the ballot in Mecklenburg County in this election cycle. Election day is Tuesday. Early voting ends tomorrow on Saturday. Also on the ballot, city council races, the race for mayor, and the 1% transit tax referendum. Early voting has been described as surging as compared to 2023. What are the current turnout figures?
Yeah, I think we're above 42,000 now. And,
43,458. Yeah. And yesterday afternoon, I checked on this at 4 o'clock, and it was 33,000. So it's 10,000 people at least voted yesterday.
So we're on track for a big turnout. You know, if I were just spitball guessing, I'd say we're on track for, I mean, this sounds small overall, but for municipal, it's big, 25%+ turnout. You know, some of these races, municipal races, you get low teens. One thing that's interesting is this turnout isn't just surging everywhere. It's also surging really in Matthews. And that could have big implications for this transit tax referendum, because Matthews is generally against the transit tax, and they've doubled their early voting totals so far versus the last election.
And the Matthews Library, one of the voting locations, early election voting locations, is one of the largest turnouts of all of the early voting locations.
Yeah, that's got to be a worrisome sign for the pro crowd.
Last week, the Mecklenburg County Commission voted to spend $1.5 million to help private developers rebuild the historic Excelsior Club on Charlotte's west side. This week, Charlotte City Council took up the question, and moments before the vote, City Council's James Mitchell celebrated with supporters.
All the supporters of the Excelsior Club, please stand up right now and take a bow. We're glad you're here. We're glad you're supporting.
That was before the vote. Gee, I wonder how the vote went. The city will now kick in $1.5 million. It was the unanimous vote, so Kennedy Property Development and Crossland Southeast will have $3 million in taxpayer money slated for their $8.3 million project. There have been other developers who have put forth plans for this. David, why is this one successful where the other ones failed?
Why do all the Eastland projects fail, Mike? And then they finally come forward. Any number of economic factors, trying to get the taxpayer funding. I mean, we've seen this over the years. And finally, it took a contractor. I believe Crosland is involved in this. They have history and experience in working with the city and coming forward on some of these developments. And obviously, it takes this type of taxpayer style investment typically to get these types of projects moving forward. I mean, the building was in such bad shape. The project is now basically completely redo this. It takes a lot of work, and it's hard to save history and make something new at the same time.
And the county commission is also picking in stuff. And it's about not just a building, but history and legacy. Let's face that.
So we have 2 minutes left. Monroe Mayor Robert Burns has been in the news a lot in the last 6 months, back in it again this week because of his decision not to seek a second term. Why that decision, David?
He told R. Dalfred Jones at WBTV that he was profoundly impacted by the Charlie Kirk assassination and that he wanted to serve Monroe and Union County on a different and possibly bigger stage. I'd be remiss to not mention that he's also faced a no confidence vote from the council there in the past in a separate incident. He's also had calls from the local NAACP leadership to be removed from office. So there could be more to the story there than just his motivations about this latest awful assassination.
And he kind of alluded to some of those troubles when he spoke with WBTV.
Listen, they didn't write a book to how to be the best mayor, okay? They didn't write a book in how to get involved in politics. No one is perfect, no one. And to act like we're perfect, then that's ridiculous.
So the Panthers are back at it again on Sunday. Andy Dalton filled in for Panthers quarterback Bryce Young last Sunday, broke the team's short-lived winning streak with a 40-9 loss at home against Buffalo. Now Bryce Young's ankle evidently has healed. He's slated to play against the Packers in Green Bay on Sunday. They are 5-1-1 on the season. The Panthers are 4-4 with 3 wins at home and 3 losses on the road. What are people saying about Sunday?
I think tough Bryce crowd, is.
They're saying tough crowd, yeah. Tough field, Lambeau Field, and a quarterback uncertainty. Bryce practiced. That was good. But they've called up a couple of more quarterbacks just in case, because Andy Dalton's hurt too.
But we are currently in second position in the NFC South. I don't know what that says about the NFC South, but it says something. Charlotte FC ended their fourth season with a home field spot in the first game of the playoffs. They lost that game on Tuesday night against New York City. And team captain Ashley Woodward said a sluggish start doomed that game.
First half cost of the game. Simple as that. Too many mistakes. Giving the ball away cheaply. And again, if you're doing that in the playoffs, you get beat. And we deserve to get beat, so... Listen, thankfully we've got two more games to put it right.
Ashley Westwood, it's a best of three series, but game two is a must win, so we'll see what happens on Saturday.
Zaha's back.
Eli Portillo, Mary C. Curtis, Hunter Sines, David Hodges, thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.